This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 273, was recorded on May 27th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Abra Silver Resource Corporation, a premier emerging silver and gold exploration company, ticker ABRA on TSX Venture and ABBRF in the United States. New York Times best-selling author and curator of the Bear Traps Report, Larry McDonald, joins me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss inflation, bond yields, market outlooks, and much more. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick's chart deck will be titled Touring the Commodity Stocks. We'll take a look at the various different commodity stocks and see where the trading opportunities lie.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump into that S&P 500 because we're back very close to the 52-week high and the market's just muddling along up here. What's your take? Do you think we punched to new highs from here?
Well, I don't know, Patrick. We've gone almost two whole weeks without a new all-time high on the stock market, and we've reached a point where most people think that's an unusual circumstance. So yeah, I think we go higher, and I think we keep going higher and higher and higher until someday this all breaks. And when it breaks, I think it's going to be really ugly, but I don't think that day is anytime soon, and I'm leaning towards the melt-up continuing. It will be really ugly someday, but you know, right now I think the conditions warrant further melt-up before there's any catalyst I can see that would cause all of this overvaluation to actually have an effect on the market.
All right, let's move on to the US dollar index. We're more or less pivoting right off that 90 handle. It's pretty much unchanged from where we were closing last week when we were recording. What do you think is the next move here on the dollar?
Well, Patrick, we traded for a good solid week there below the 90 handle on the dollar index, and I think that's kind of a first. Yeah, we're back above it now, but by what, like 3 basis points as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon? We did test 89 spot 50, which has been a critical level. We didn't close below it, but boy, you know, we're getting closer to it. It feels to me like we've kind of reached a moment of truth here, Patrick. This market's either going to continue consolidating sideways like it has been, or we're going to see a breakdown below 89. Which one's it going to be? Well, I'm not sure, but why don't we ask this week's feature interview guest, Larry McDonald, that very question.
All right, Eric, well, let's get to the crude oil markets because we're very close to a 52-week new high, quick recovery off of that dip the other week. Do you think we're heading towards 70 here?
Patrick, I do think that we're headed toward 70 and higher, but it's not quite time yet. And the reason is I think the market is still just a little bit preoccupied with this question of what happens when Iranian supply comes back on the market. And my answer to that is it's already been priced into the market. Everybody knows this was coming. What we didn't know is the exact timing of when it would come. It looks like maybe it's going to happen a little bit sooner. Maybe that's going to affect the price a little bit, but I really don't think it's big and important. It has been holding the market back, and right now we're fighting critical resistance right at 66 spot 60. As we're speaking now, we're only a nickel shy of that, so it's possible that we'll close above 66 spot 60, and I hope we do, because that would be the indication that maybe that breakout that I'm expecting above not just 66.60, but eventually breaking out above the previous cycle high at $68. I think it's all coming, Patrick, but I don't think it's coming until June, you know, until we get into the first or second week of June. I think that's when the rally starts and it continues. And eventually by Labor Day, we end up with a high oil price on the year, somewhere between $80 and $90, which is where I think we're headed. So that's my outlook, but I don't think that all happens until people stop being preoccupied with whether or not Iranian supply is going to be an issue or not. And so far, that seems to be what's on everybody's mind, but we're right on the edge of breaking past 66 spot 60. And I think if we get a daily close above, it's likely that the upside will continue from there. We'll see what happens.
Eric, how did the inventories come in?
was another drawdown this week, Patrick. Crude oil drawing down 1.7 million barrels. Now, that's going by the number everybody follows, which is the one that excludes the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And the logic for why we exclude the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is that's not commercial storage. That's the government storage of oil. Well, wait a minute. In this circumstance, it really is private storage. There was an exemption made because of the COVID crisis allowing private storage in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And that's what's being unwound here. So I think we really had a drawdown of 3.3 million barrels. That's the number including the SPR. But the official number is only 1.7 million. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 1 million barrels. Gasoline drawing down 1.7 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 3 million barrels. So between 3 million barrels distillates, 1.7 gasoline and 1.7 crude, you've got a total petroleum product build of 6.4 million barrels. Needless to say, that's bullish and it's been helping the price action.
All right, Eric, let's talk gold because another week, another set of multi-month highs as bullion has now temporarily seen highs above 1900. Does this keep going or are we overdue for a little pullback?
Well, I definitely think it keeps going, at least in the big picture sense of things. But hey, we just broke through the 200-day moving average. And a very common pattern in technical analysis is when you break through a major level, you see that breakout, and then you go down and test that level as support before moving higher. We still haven't had that back down to the 200-day moving average, test it as support, and then move higher from there. Doesn't mean we're going to get it, but if it does happen, don't let it spook you out. It's a good sign, not a bad sign. Where I think we're eventually heading, though, Patrick, is to new all-time highs in gold, well over $2,000, probably well over $2,500 within the next couple of years.
All right, Eric, let's touch on that 10-year treasury yield. So we had high inflation print. We have a big new fiscal spend coming. We have all these different data points and some yields just don't seem to be reacting to it and actually, in fact, backing off. We're at 1.60 here at the time of recording. What's your take on where we are with interest rates?
Well, the short answer is I don't know. I don't have any strong conviction, but my kind of thinking here, my initial thought is I think that what's happening is a lot of people got spooked out by the government spend and, oh my gosh, it means they're going to have to float all these bonds. And, you know, that's what led to that backing up of yields. I think the market has sort of thought it through now and realized, wait a minute, you know, the Fed's going to be involved in buying some of that debt. You know, they're not going to let rates get to a certain point. And the market, I think, has processed. Yeah, as much as they're going to issue a whole bunch of debt, they're also going to probably buy up a lot of that debt. It probably is not going to lead to the backing up of rates that some people feared. Now, that's a guess on my part. It could go the other way, which is I and a bunch of other people could find out that, yeah, it really can lead to a backing up in yields of, you know, we're looking at 4% next year. I don't think it's going to go that way. I think it's going to go the other way, but I'm going to keep asking our feature interview guests because, frankly, it's still a mystery to me.
Well, Eric's interview with Larry McDonald is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Abex Technologies. In addition to sponsoring Macro Voices, Abex also produces Smarter Markets, a weekly podcast that airs every Saturday morning on all the major podcast platforms. Smarter Markets brings together the leading minds in macroeconomics, technology, and commodities to explore how capital markets can be redesigned to better serve market participants and society as a whole. The first episode in Michelle Dennity's five-part series about the role of digital innovation in advancing the ESG economy, features Gajan Kandia, CEO of Hitachi Vantara, and is available now. The second, featuring Greg Lavender, Chief Technology Officer at VMware and Managing Director of Cloud Architecture at Citigroup, airs this Saturday morning. But you won't get Smarter Markets on your Macro Voices feed. You have to subscribe separately to Smarter Markets in your podcast app to listen to this free podcast.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Larry McDonald, the man who wrote the New York Times best-selling book on the collapse of Lehman Brothers. These days, Larry writes the Bear Traps Report. Larry, it's great to have you with us. Let's start with a question I've been asking just about everyone, because everybody's changing their story, which is inflation versus deflation. So many of our formerly devout deflationists have turned inflationista on us. Where do you stand? What do you see on the horizon?
Yeah, I'm in the inflation camp as well. It's, if you think about the previous decade and the investment community globally, I think that, we're looking at $100 trillion of bonds that are below 2% in yield and close to $17 trillion in the NASDAQ 100. And so net, the entire investment community of the planet Earth is essentially in a 2010 to 2020 portfolio allocation. And I think what's been happening over the last like 60 days to 90 days is we've had these tremors, these growth to value tremors in the market. And they've been just like tremors before a quake, they've been picking up with intensity. And it's clear that to me that there's just literally trillions of dollars that's misallocated that's going to have to migrate. And right now, there's probably already a trillion that's already moved. But, three or four, maybe five more trillion has to move in the next 6 months. And so that's where, the system is buckling a little bit. But what we're looking at is the previous decade, we had Brexit's, trade wars, obviously COVID, austerity in Europe. Austerity because of obviously Greece. We had a Grexit and a Brexit, massive austerity in Germany, with incredible surpluses, and austerity in the United States. We had a sequester that took the deficit from $1.1 trillion to $500 billion over 3 years between 2011 to 2014 or so. So, this is just, we had supply chains that were smooth as silk. And so we have like 10 or 20 things from 2010 to 2020 that fostered this incredible deflationary period, this just mind-boggling bull market in bonds, to the point where in the fourth quarter of 2019, bonds were bid without in September, October, no offer. Just incredible. And that was before COVID. So now as we look forward, we're looking at a Biden administration that is so determined. They lost the 2010 midterms by 63 seats, Obama, Biden. And they're going to spend like there's no tomorrow, especially in the third, fourth quarter of this year with a new, enhanced powers of reconciliation, which you only need 50 votes. And at the same time, there's just more fiscal largesse around the world. And so the pressures on inflation are substantial, much more substantial than they were 10 years ago, and especially if you look at the Fed as well.
Let's talk about what this means for Treasury yields, because some people have been saying, hey, if we've got inflation coming, it has to mean that we're headed toward a regime of higher bond yields. Other people say, no, wait a minute. It's nothing about inflation that causes higher bond yields. It's policymakers reacting to inflation that caused the higher bond yields. And there's a lot of reasons to think they're not going to do that this time. So how should we think about the relationship between the coming inflation, if you think an inflation is coming, which I certainly do, and what it's going to mean for the regime of Treasury yields that we have?
So, so the Fed is doing $120 billion a month of QE, and there's some talk. We run a Bloomberg chat with about 650 institutional investors on the buy side, so pension funds, mutual funds, hedge funds. And I'm hearing more and more talk about a shift toward, because the housing market's on fire and they're buying, $120 billion a month of mortgage-backed securities and treasuries. So I think one of the surprises looking forward that will, if yields get out of control, which they should toward the end of the year, I think with passionately and with the highest conviction that politicians are going to force the Fed into some type of yield curve control. And, we're talking about another $2 trillion to $2.5 trillion of spending. And we're talking about a $5 trillion fiscal plan that's already been passed. So Interest on the debt now is almost 10% of the budget. And entitlements and interest is close to 70% of the budget. So there really isn't a lot of room for the Fed and Treasury. So at some point in the, you know, I think within the next 6-9 months, the Biden team in their quest to win that 2022 midterm and really spend the way they didn't spend in 2010, they feel like they didn't go big enough. They're going to force the Fed into some type of yield curve control. And the first stage of that will probably be they just pull back on the mortgage purchases and put that allocation over to treasuries. And that should be very supportive of metals, gold, silver. And I think that's why we've had this big turnaround in gold and silver. You know, clearly, growth expectations have come down because we've had, you know, a tough jobs report. But at the end of the day, the market's starting to look forward to this more fiscal globally. And the Fed, and if you just look at all the Fed speak, Rich Clarida has, you know, talked up Operation Twist type operations. And this would be like a new type of Operation Twist. So, yes, I see yields going much higher later in the year. And then the Fed trying to, you know, pull creative levers to arrest that ascent.
Larry, let's talk about where we stand with respect to this global pandemic that is upon us. On the one hand, it seems like at least the pandemic is starting to come under control. But the other side of this, which not too many people are talking about, is the U.S. government has finally come out and officially recognized something, which I think has been obvious from the beginning, which is that the most likely explanation for where this virus came from is a lab leak, not a natural source. And it's not a crazy debunked conspiracy theory. It's actually the most likely explanation for how this happened. That seems to me to set the stage. Now that we have the U.S. government officially saying that this virus may very well have been leaked from the Wuhan Institute of Virology, possibly from research that was being funded by the U.S. government, boy, it just seems to set the stage for maybe another round of significant geopolitical tension with China in coming years. How do you see this unfolding? As I know you're something of an expert on U.S.-China relations.
Yes, I mean, it's amazing. If Trump says it's poo-pooed, but now it's kind of gone mainstream, and it's almost better that Trump's not saying it because now people are taking it, you know, much more serious. And there's two things really. There's that dynamic around the COVID origination, and then this. I think another backdrop to this is this: the insults that China is put forth on the Paris Climate Accord are just, I mean, just off the charts. You're talking about 1,000 coal plants that are in operation now in China, and another 25 to 30 that are in planning stages. And you're talking about a substantial, you know, whatever Europe's done around. Europe last year took 17 gigawatts off the global stage in terms of carbon, and China just put that on and then some. And so there's a real conflict coming up here where I think we're going to have, like in the Trump days, we had the trade war. And at some point there's going to be, I think over the next year, more sanctions toward green sanctions on China. And, you know, the big winner there would be U.S. nuclear power or uranium. But that's one thing that I think is becoming very, very, you know, obnoxious. It's India, China, especially China, the amount of coal plants that are coming online relative to their promises of 2016. And then this COVID situation around this new cycle around information coming out of Wuhan, both of those things set up for, a much higher level of tensions between the U.S. and China.
So let's translate all of this backstory into a market outlook. What is the big picture macro outlook in terms of equities, bonds, everything else? What do you see? What do you expect?
Well, the big thing is the reopening. So India a month ago was in a horrific COVID cycle, and now cases are crashing in India, crashing in Europe. We're going to have much better vaccine distribution in India. India is a colossal diesel fuel user, oil user. You're talking about 6% of the global consumption, up from 3% maybe 8 or 9 years ago. So, and growing fast. I mean, India population is growing 3 times faster than the European continent. Or I should say more so Germany and Italy, for example. So you're talking about 1.4 billion people that's growing at a very strong clip. And you're talking about a large group of people that are still vastly addicted to diesel fuel and oil. And so this sets up for, with vaccine distribution, with a much better situation in Europe in terms of reopening and vacations. I just think this ESG situation in the United States and around the world in terms of oil and shale is just unbelievable. And coal, I mean, we're going to have in the next 12 months the most spectacular ESG backfire, because we're going to have a vast reopening. Demand's going to come back really strong, especially in countries like India as they come back online. I mean, think about it. India and Europe were just in a horrific lockdown, and oil was essentially unch for a month or two. I mean, oil should have been off 20% on that news. So that tells you that there's a pent-up demand problem, and the U.S. doesn't have the ability to. The last 10 years, Eric, because the ESG backdrop was so liberal in the United States and wasn't there as vigilant as it is today, the last 10 years, the U.S. could ramp up production very fast. And now, because of ESG, I mean, I talked to a lot of bankers in our chat, in our Bloomberg chat, our institutional chat, and around the world. And just the ability of coal companies and shale companies to finance projects has just collapsed. And the snapback in the United States has lost the control of the production snapback. And that's going to put more price control in the hands of the Saudis and the Russians. And they're just going to drive, I think we could have $100 oil and much higher coal prices over the next 12 months, and especially in the ESG side on coal, because met coal is the steel producer of the world right now. I mean, we're years and years and years away from hydrogen-produced steel. So you're talking about companies like Arch Coal, ARCH, that I think would be a double over the next 12 months, trading at 3.5 times EBITDA. Dividend increase probably coming by year end. So we're looking at, we have a basket of what we call our ESG backfire basket. And that's kind of the focus of it is energy, is oil and coal.
Larry, I couldn't agree more on higher oil prices coming. Talk to me a little bit about what the drivers are that you see there, but also where do you see the energy plays specifically? Is it just in oil and natural gas, or are other things like renewables and nuclear going to come into the fray? Where do you see the energy trading opportunity in this market?
Yeah, so exactly. So on the energy side with oil, just the backdrop of the ability to come back online with production in a faster format is that's much more limited. So we see really a vast supply problem climaxing in the second quarter of next year as the summer driving season approaches. But from a perspective of China and India and the amount of coal plants on the earth and their relative pickup of nuclear power, there's tremendous pressure on China and India to take down their additional coal plants and put more of a nuclear component into that mix. At the same time, you've got in the United States, John Kerry that's flipped on nuclear power, Jennifer Grantham at the Department of Energy, she's flipped dramatically. The Biden team's flipped dramatically in terms of energy support for the U.S. nuclear power industry. So there's just, once again, this is a similar to the oil dynamic, but times 10. The world in 2025 to 2030 is short about 10 million pounds of uranium, I think, because China has to double their stated plan to bring at least, I think, probably 60 nuclear power plants online over the next 8 years, an additional 60 in China, and an additional 25 to 30 in India. And then the United States, the U.S., you know, the Biden administration and the Trump team both in agreement where uranium has been a national security problem because we're not producing our own uranium in the United States. And so what happens is when you have this ESG dynamic around fossil fuels like natural gas, we're seeing much higher natural gas prices, higher coal prices. That makes nuclear power much, much, much more competitive. And this ESG dynamic around natural gas is powerful. You've got, I think, the new handle is 3 to 5 on natural gas. That's been a real, that created this 10-year, helped create this 10-year bear market for nuclear power and uranium. So if you're a uranium purchaser, like at a power plant for the last 10 years, you could sit back. You didn't have to prop what we call, you didn't have to front buy or proprietary trade your uranium inventory. You could just sit back and purchase. And we're seeing all kinds of indications that the power plants in the United States and around the world are starting to prop uranium. And we're seeing some institutional clients trying to front run this process. And we've seen China already, you know, they're upset about the iron ore stocking. And so what happens in a dynamic like this, when you have just tons and tons of unintended consequences from government policy, we call it the Cobra effect. But what happens is in the free market, a lot of market participants will try to front run demand, and that'll force a lot of these power plants to pay up and then start to buy forward uranium. And so the uranium industry is only $21 billion in size. I mean, it's absolute joke. I mean, Bitcoin is still close to half a trillion dollars in size. Dogecoin is like, I think, 50 billion in size. And the entire uranium industry is worth $21 billion, $22 billion. I mean, this is the easiest, the best risk-reward trade I've seen in probably my life. I think you have like 5 to 8 times upside and, you know, clearly 40% downside. But your risk-reward to being long URNM, CCJ, URA, you know, these ETFs in the uranium space is just the best I've ever seen. And on top of it, the Edge, you know, the U2's famous player there in the famous U2 group, you've got celebrities like him that just in the last 2 weeks are coming out nuclear. So the wokest of musicians on the planet Earth have now switched to supporting nuclear. It's the only way to get to the green meadow. It's the only way for China. It's the only way for India. It's the only way for the United States. And I think that the world is just vastly supplied, about 10 million pounds short over the next 10 years. So we're going to just see one of the best trades of our lifetimes in this space.
The URNM ETF has more than doubled in the short period since they advertised on Macro Voices. I'm personally attributing the entire turnaround in the nuclear space to Macro Voices advertising, but I also respect that there are other macro drivers, which I suppose could have had something to do with it. Let's talk about where the real opportunity is going to be for investors. Is it nuclear? Is it going to be, you know, some people are saying the copper demand has got to be just off the charts to build out the electric grid that's going to be necessary in order to support electric vehicles. Where are the best trades in the greening of the global economy?
One of the trades that we like the most is in the hydrogen fuel cell space on the metal side. So Impala Platinum, a South African company trading in a very, very cheap multiple, about 2.5 times EBITDA, and trading at a 20% free cash flow yield. You're talking about platinum in the production of hydrogen, which is a major component. And so right now in the entire dynamic of demand for platinum, there isn't a hydrogen demand element right now. But if you think about electric vehicles and you think about big and large vehicles, much larger vehicles like buses and trucks and ships, hydrogen is your answer there, much more so than electric vehicles. So electric vehicles is your copper play. And we definitely see, you know, a massive global shortage in the copper space. But for larger vehicles. Last week, there was a Shell deal, and we're seeing more and more large-scale transactions on the hydrogen fuel cell side. And it's just a matter of time. Like this time next year, there's going to be a much higher demand element in the platinum space. And so Impala Platinum, Stillwater, SBSW, those two equities are, you know, once again, I see 300, 400% upside, you know, 40% downside, but the greening of the large scale buses, trucks of Europe and the United States are going to go hydrogen. That's going to create a new 20% additional demand for platinum. And the amount of platinum on Earth relative to, say, gold is just literally like 1/100th in terms of annual mining. And so we just don't have a lot of platinum out there. At the end of the day, Eric, there's something going on that is just so, you know, despicable around the media's focus on this green revolution. And nobody's doing the math on how we're going to get there in terms of the metal side. And our team has spent a lot of time in the last like 6 months, but companies like Tech Resources on the copper side, we think that stock's a double from here with their properties in the copper space. And then Impala Platinum and SBSW Stillwater on the platinum side.
Larry, I want to move on to an advanced terminology topic that I got from your newsletter. For anyone who is not familiar with your writing, please help us understand the new financial terminology. Alpha male central banker. What does that mean?
Well, if you think of like the 2010 to 2020 period, the alpha male central bank was the Federal Reserve. And the Fed was pounding their chest, you know, hawkish, in 2011, 12, 13, created the taper tantrum in 2013, and then they robustly proclaimed in 2018 that they could take $50 billion a month of balance sheet off the Federal Reserve balance sheet down, $50 billion a month at one point. That's what they were claiming they could do. And then in 2015, 16, once again, they were promising us, pounding the table, they were going to deliver 2015, 16, 8 rate hikes. And each time the dollar ripped, the amount of trade in the world that is in dollars is just enormous, you know, 62%. The amount of debt on the planet Earth that's in dollars. Emerging markets, the Federal Reserve blew up the global economy 3 different times. Countries like Brazil were in flames with massive political risk. 2018, because you had oil prices moving higher with the dollar. So if you're in a country like an emerging market country where there is no rail system and major commodities are transported by trucks, I mean, this is just a devastating blow to countries like Peru, Chile, and Brazil. And it created incredible amounts of civil unrest to the point where it looked like Ciro Gomes was going to win the 2018 election in Brazil, and if, you know, real radical leftists. So these things have massive repercussions. And then we go into COVID, where the central banks and the governments of the emerging markets had nowhere near the bandwidth to take on this beast of COVID and to spend their way through it. So essentially what happened behind the scenes, and we're convinced, we said this to clients last year, the only way out of this is a globally coordinated alpha male handoff from the Fed, was the alpha male in 2013, 2015, 16, and 2018, to the PBOC in China, the Bank of England. And lo and behold, the Bank of Canada is the big taperer now. So we have a situation where the Federal Reserve has transferred the reins of the alpha male central bank to other central banks. This is putting tremendous pressure on the dollar, and it's something that investors just haven't seen, aren't used to, and they're all waking up to it. At the same time, the global economy is reopening. That's why there's just been so much relentless pressure on the dollar, and we see a major break here. We think the dollar's, you know, it's been on 2018 support for much of the last 2 weeks, and this is the second time it's been down there. And when it breaks, it's going to be an incredible flush, and it should break as we reopen globally. And as these alpha male central banks around the world are far, far more hawkish, pulling back accommodation much faster than the Fed. The Fed is now a woke central bank, a social justice Fed that is dedicated to fighting inequality, looking at U6 unemployment in the United States at near 11%. You're talking about 8.5 million Americans that are still unemployed out of the U.S. labor force relative to January 2020. 8.5 million people. So the Fed has to dig in here in their woke social justice inequality Fed regime. They've been thoroughly embarrassed of the previous decade. You could make the argument that the Fed helped put Trump in office, but those dollar moves decimated middle-class voters in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. Those states flipped to Trump. So this whole dynamic of a social justice Fed and an alpha male central banks in Canada, in the United Kingdom, and China has flipped the switch and has put tremendous pressure, secular pressure on the dollar. It's going to make new lows as we speak.
Tell me more about that breakdown that you see coming in the dollar. What drives it and how far can it go? Because as I look at this chart, you get below 89 on the dollar index, at least from a conventional technical analysis standpoint. There's not a lot of technical levels to look at there until you get much lower.
Yeah, exactly. And this is why you need to be reallocate the portfolio out of tech and growth and into more value names. We've seen these growth to value tremors over the last couple of months, and they're getting stronger and stronger. And, you know, portfolios like the EWU ETF that are long companies like Glencore, Rio Tinto, big commodity producers, oil companies like Royal Dutch Shell and BP. You want to be long a portfolio that has exposure to global value stocks, Vodafone, Glaxo, IBM names. I mean, these names have just been shredded. I mean, massively underowned. And there's a couple trillion bucks that's going to come out because we're going back to more of a 1970s, 1980s regime where value outperforms growth. And the dollar, once it breaks, the forces are just are so many now because, once again, the Biden team, it's the opposite of 2012. In 2011-12, you had the sequester coming in where Republicans were taking that budget deficit from $1.1 trillion down to $500 billion through they forced the sequester onto President Obama. And the Democrats don't want to lose that midterm, that 2022. At the same time, the Fed was, you know, in a, you know, taper regime, and now we're in a social justice regime. And at the same time, you have $64 trillion of gross domestic product globally, $64 trillion of GDP that's outside the United States. There's only $20 trillion in and $64 out. And guess what? That $64 trillion is reopening at a much faster pace now. So the U.S., what they call American exceptionalism, that was like January, February, where the U.S. had the fastest mover advantage on the vaccines, on distribution, on COVID tests. But now as the world reopens and as COVID fleets, this is what's going to break the back of the dollar. At the same time, the Biden team's going to come up with this spending plan in the fourth quarter. And it's just, I just see this, it's going to be just a colossal flush. And that will break the back of these tech stocks. And it's going to be the biggest portfolio reallocation of our lives because everybody is set up for the previous decade. Everybody's set up in deflation portfolios and everybody's going to rotate into value names that are really have been unloved for a very, very long time.
Well, if you're right and this event happens, I mean, I think you and I agree that a breakdown below 89 on the U.S. dollar index, that's a once in every so many decades event because that's such a key technical level that if it breaks that, it's probably going not just a little bit lower, but a whole lot lower. So what are the implications of this? Obviously, you just mentioned a couple of them. It means we need to be thinking about having things like gold and oil in our portfolio because those are the things that are going to benefit from a weakening dollar. What are the other consequences and implications of this change that you see on the horizon?
Yeah, exactly. So it's been 10 years of owning financial assets. Every family in America, every wealthy family in the United States of America is long financial assets, and they don't own any hard assets. The allocation of commodities and portfolios and value stocks is at 20-year lows. And so that's the biggest change. The other to really look forward is this dynamic around, and our next book is on this subject around the generational conflicts that are going to come up the next 10 years are, you know, just blood curdling, because the millennials have been handed 170, 160 trillion of unfunded liabilities. They now have 30 trillion of federal debt. You have the top 100 companies in the United States, the top 100 control 91% of the profits. And when I was growing up in the 80s, that number was like 65, 70. And you just have this raging inequality that is just, you know, underneath the surface, there's just the social bubbling is coming forth. Now, the good news is the millennials are going to inherit the next 15, 20 years, 70 trillion of wealth, right? So you're going to inherit the 70 trillion of wealth, but that wealth is in tech stocks, Bitcoin, property, you know, growth stocks, 401ks. So if that wealth gets a hit, and that millennial group that has been saddled with this colossal pile of debt, at some point there's a risk of what, you know, we call in the Bible, we look back to the Bible, and you can go back thousands and thousands of years. We've seen multiple debt jubilees where one generation is handed, you know, a really bad deal financially and just walks away from, and we're already seeing it with student loans, you know, there's just a social movement, you know, not to pay. And, you know, one thing the woke movement does and doesn't do is it doesn't stop from one topic to the next. It keeps going. These people don't stop, my friends. So they just keep going. So they'll go from, you know, student loans, and they'll eventually work their way into some type of mortgage debt or government debt. And in some respects, you can see some of the point, because this generation is being saddled with a colossal financial obligation that they really didn't have anything to do with.
Let's talk a little bit about what we should expect from this reopening. So many people that I hear, analysts, pundits, saying, well, you know, there's going to be very, very compromised demand for travel. People are going to be afraid. They're not going to want to go out. You know, Larry, I'm just not buying it. I just take the way I feel, which is, look, I'm waiting for this thing to be over. I don't want to go travel if it's still endangering my life to do so. But as soon as it's safe, if anything, this pandemic has taught me time is precious. I want to go travel like I've never traveled before. And I predict most of the world is going to feel that way. Of course, not everybody can afford to, but to the extent that people can afford to. And by the way, they're going to be getting, a lot of them, a significant amount of stimulus payments and other transfer payments. People are going to spend money on travel and you know, party like it's 1999 as soon as the borders reopen. I guess that's a very non-consensus view. What do you think?
I agree. I'll tell you. So our book came out. It's now in 12 languages, and it's one of the best-selling business books in the world. It was just voted by the CFA Institute, one of the top 20 books of all time. So when you have a bestseller, I tell my wife once a month, if we sell 1 million books, we'll break even on our Lehman stock as a former Lehman trader. And, and I'll tell you some fascinating data. So the bear trap support typically in a year will spend, because of the speeches around the world, we'll typically have 4 or 5 to 6 speeches. And you know, so many times those speeches are paid for in terms of travel, but we're seeing clients, we're doing things. So we'll spend, call it $150,000 a year of travel, and we'll typically do events in maybe 6 countries each year, 6 to 8. And so last year, that budget went down from, say, $150,000 for our small company to $9,000. And now this year, the amount of events that we've seen come back online, we're not going to spend back to $150,000. You know, it's a small company. But I could see us up at 100 by year end, and I could see it's well over 150 by next year. So when you talk to families, and we have a lot of different, we probably have 700 wealth advisors that are our clients, and they're going to do like at least 2 times the vacations that they didn't do last year. And there's a real feeling around the people that suffered, you know, the people in the hotels, the chambermaids, the bartenders. You know, you want to get out there and take some time and spend and support some of the people that went through an extremely difficult time. At the same time, you want to get out, you know, get rid of this cabin fever. So that's where this dynamic around energy prices and this unintended consequences of ESG has taken so much supply offline that if this travel revolution really picks up, and granted, there's places in the world, like in France, the mobility isn't as easy as it once was, but, you know, especially in airports, but you can drive through Europe. So you're going to just see a colossal pickup in energy demand and a real reopening demand. And I completely agree. I think we're going to have a much bigger surprise on the upside in terms of travel demand.
Larry, before we close, I want to ask you a final question on the energy sector, because I know you have a lot of background on the credit side of markets. And I want to talk specifically about what the end of the age of oil is going to look like in terms of its credit dynamics. And what I mean by that is, very specifically, a lot of people are saying, look, you know, we're in the final decade or the final 2 decades. Nobody's really sure how long, but we're going to shift away from fossil fuels to electric vehicles and so forth. And well, therefore, it can only mean one thing, which is energy prices are going to eventually crash. And I think the opposite, Larry. I think what's going to happen is we're going to run out of credit to invest in new production and so forth, because everybody agrees that it's a go-nowhere dead industry. And we're going to end up unable to supply and meet that last demand for petroleum, because everybody assumed the whole energy industry was going out of business and nobody invested in anything. And you end up with a crisis at the end where there isn't enough because you haven't completed the transition soon enough and nobody wants to invest in the old stuff. How do you see this playing out? Do you think we have a situation at the end of the age of oil where there's too much of it, we produce too much, and we're just never sure what we're going to do with all that extra oil that we dug up? Or are we going to have a shortage?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is a classic unintended consequences ESG overdose that is going to have the most spectacular cobra effect, where, you know, we talk about in India in 1890, they had a cobra problem in the countryside, in the communities, in the towns and the cities. So there was a coordination with the King of England, and they put a 1 pound bounty on every cobra. And lo and behold, it worked for a little while. You actually had an arrest of the cobra dynamic. So the cobras were captured. But then all of a sudden, a number of creative cobra, you know, farmers started farming these cobras and selling them back to the United Kingdom and the Indian government. So you had this dynamic where the government actually had to come in and cancel the whole regime policy plan of cobras. And what did the farmers do? They released all the cobras into the wild. So 6 years later, you had 3 times the amount of cobras. So this is the unintended consequences of government policy. And with the energy space, I completely agree. I think it's worse with coal. Like coal prices could triple because you just have had such little access to capital markets financing. And so that's why we really like the Arch Resources names and things like that. But on the energy space, this is so important, because I spent, before our book, A Colossal Failure of Common Sense, I ran one of our distressed businesses at Lehman. And so I lived through a lot of credit cycles with the commodity names. Commodity names were always big high-yield bond issuers. And what has happened over the last year, this is once again the unintended consequences. The Fed has been, you know, so accommodative on the asset purchases for such a long period of time, they're not allowing the business cycle to function, right? So the traditional business cycle, which has a cleansing process where companies, if they don't finance themselves correctly, they'll run into a credit market that starts to shut down, and there's a huge default cycle. This whole dynamic has been dramatically changed with this incredible amount of accommodation. And this sets up an, I think, a spectacular opportunity on some of the equity sides, and equity plays in the commodity space, because these companies have been able to extend maturities much further and much more profound than they have in previous decades. And what that does, Eric, to the equity, your equities have become essentially a long-term cheap option or a warrant. In other words, the normal cycle of debt financing and near-term debt maturities in the commodity space, you know, the typical default cycle that we saw in 2000, massive default cycle we saw in the energy space and coal space in 2016, Peabody, one of the most profound, 2016-18, some of the most profound energy companies went bankrupt. Now all these energy companies have extended maturities vastly, more in an incredible, profound manner, which I've never seen before. And so your equities in the commodity space, and in any cycle, the first move is into the quality thing. So think about the commodity cycle. I've seen this in the high yield market, investment grade market. The first move is into the quality names, and then the mid quality. So if you look over the last year, everybody went into gold first, and then toward the spring and summer of last year, people moved into copper. Then they moved into oil in the fourth quarter, you know, when we started to get the vaccines. And now uranium and coal are the plays. So you will always will see this cycle of the tertiary parts of the commodity space. The demand will start to pick up. And where investors move from the higher quality names to the lower quality names. And I just think that the credit market backdrop is so supportive for the commodity equity space now, much more than you're talking about a sector that went through a colossal, horrific default cycle in 2016, and then another in the fourth quarter of 2018, and then a COVID default cycle. So the commodity space has been through three, you know, massive default cycles. These companies are lean and mean, and we have a model portfolio. People can check it out on our beartraps.com website. But I think that's one of the most sexy stories for the next couple of years is some of these commodity equities with much cleaner balance sheets.
Well, Larry, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Listeners, we have a treat for you, which is in your Research Roundup email, you'll find a link to download a sample issue of the Bear Traps Report, which is Larry's newsletter. I think you'll find it extremely informative and very much worth the read. Larry, before I let you go, I want to touch on your book. Now, your first book, A Colossal Failure of Common Sense, was pretty much the book to read on the collapse of Lehman Brothers, New York Times bestseller. Very, very successful book. You've written another book. What's that about?
Okay, so we're you know, I think it'll be out by hopefully by the fourth quarter, first quarter next year. But it starts at the Lehman era and it connects the Lehman. If you think about global populism and markets, this Lehman event triggered just a crazy dynamic between the millennials, the Gen Xers, and the baby boomers, right? So the Lehman event created, you know, such a horrific financial crisis. To get out of that, the Fed and, you know, more the U.S. government took on a decent amount of debt. And then as we move toward COVID, so you've had the Lehman-COVID connection, those two events have dramatically increased unfunded liabilities and just the national debt of the United States. So we go back to Lehman, we start there, and we look forward at the next, you know, 30 years. And, you know, Andrew Tytler and Alexis de Tocqueville, some famous economic philosophers that go back to the 1700s and 1800s, always talked about a cycle that my dad brought up to me when I was about my teens, late teens. And if you think about the cycles of republics and democracies over the last 3,000 years, you always, there's a start out, there's an origination. Think about the United States, there's an origination in bondage, and then you move to patriotism, entrepreneurship, abundance, you know, massive wealth creation phase, and then a dependency phase, and then an apathy phase. And then invariably, these cycles end up back in bondage because when the voters realize they can vote themselves and raid the public treasury. At some point in time, too many people in societies, whether it be in Rome over 1,000 years ago to the Mayan civilizations, to Argentina, to Venezuela, even Puerto Rico, you've had these cycles where, you know, if you look at Venezuela now, you're back in bondage. And if you look at Buenos Aires, and you're talking about one of the most beautiful, pristine gem cities in the 1800s on the planet Earth. You know, the wealth in Buenos Aires is just incredible. So these cycles have been going on for thousands of years. And the United States has the blessing of the Federal Reserve and MMT that's extending the cycle. So instead of having to sell bonds, the U.S. voters are voting themselves to raid the public treasury, and the Federal Reserve is financing that. And so the question is, does that extreme financing weaken the dollar this year and next year? And then eventually we go back toward this cycle. And I'm not saying we're going to be in bondage or anything like that in the United States, but it's clearly, you can see that we're in the middle to later innings of the dependence to apathy stage, where an incredibly large percentage of Americans are supported by transfer payments. And, you know, we're talking about, you know, the largest percentage in the last 100 years. And so these events have dramatic consequences, and that's what our book is all about, is looking forward and how do we invest in that type of regime.
Well, Larry, we look forward to getting you back on the show in a few months for another update. Patrick Zarezna and I will be back after this message from our sponsor. Looking for exposure to rising silver and gold prices? Abra Silver Resource Corporation, ticker ABRA on the TSX Venture Exchange and ABBRF in the United States, is rapidly emerging as one of the premier silver and gold-focused exploration companies. Abra Silver has an advanced stage project with a large resource base of over 140 million ounces on a silver equivalent basis and continues to announce several very high-grade silver and gold drill results, with more results still pending. Abra Silver is very well-funded with a strong shareholder base and excellent exploration upside potential. You can find a link to the latest press release in the Research Roundup email. Visit abrasilver.com for more information. That's abrasilver.com for more information on this silver and gold exploration stock.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Zarezna.
Eric, it was great to have Larry finally on the show. You know, he really has some strong convictions about things like the dollar and on so many of these different commodities. So I decided to put together a chart book just to kind of talk about all of these things. Looking forward to kind of going through it all here. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, Patrick, I thought the most important thing about this interview was the extent of Larry's conviction on the dollar bearish outlook. And I'm not agreeing or disagreeing with him. I really don't know. But what struck me about this is, you know, the market's going to tell us, because frankly, that 89 level really kind of has to hold on the dollar index. If you just look at the chart from a technical analysis standpoint, if it doesn't hold, the next support is way the heck below that. There's lots of room for it to just crash from there. So it kind of has to hold in case it doesn't. And the way I'm looking at this is I don't think I'm smart enough to really have a view. I don't have the confidence that Larry does, but I do think we're going to find out pretty soon here. Either the dollar's going to break below 89 in the next few months, or it's not. And if it doesn't, I think it kind of makes an important point. And if it does, well, then I think it's probably going to keep going. I don't really have any strong conviction about where that's going or what the outcome's going to be, but it does make me think, Patrick, that I really ought to be getting my thinking around the US dollar kind of together and be ready for it when it does happen, if it happens. So let's go to the postgame chart book. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to the homepage, macrovoices.com, look for the red button that says looking for the downloads right above Larry's picture on the homepage. Patrick, let's take a look at page two, where you've got the U.S. dollar index. What are your thoughts? If we did get a breakdown below that 89 level, what do you think the next logical target is? Seems to me like it's not just a little bit lower, it's a lot lower.
Right. I mean, I want to make a couple of bigger observations and then talk about some targets. I mean, one of the interesting things is that a lot of people, when they hear about the idea that the U.S. dollar is going to have some big bear market breakdown, they immediately associate it with the U.S. dollar losing its world reserve currency status, and somehow it's the breaking of the dollar. But, you know, when you go and look at the last, you know, 30, 40 years of charts on the dollar, there have been two occasions where the U.S. dollar lost 40%+ of its value in these kind of like half-decade-long trends. And we really have been in a very sideways trade range bound market for the last 5 years. And we have not had a big currency move. And it really does ask the question whether one is coming here. And more importantly, if we did have a dollar breakdown, I mean, especially for something like the dollar index, which is trade weighted against predominantly the euro, it by default implies that the euro would strengthen immensely over that period. And the question is, in a period where they have themselves all sorts of issues with debt and things like that, can they sustain a much stronger currency on a relative basis? And one way or another, we are at a pretty critical moment. And this is something that Larry was talking about and yourself. And it is a moment where we're going to find out whether this trade range that's been in place more or less for the last 5 years is finally broken. Obviously, a retest of lows that we saw from 2008 to 2014, which are all around the 80 level on the index, are entirely on the table if we have a breakdown. And this is, I think, one of the bigger macro questions to solve. I think almost all the major commodity bull markets that we have seen in the past often came on the back of a weak dollar cycle. And so a breakdown here of this 90 level would certainly be a tailwind for that commodity bull market story, which we're going to be talking about.
I definitely agree that it would be a major tailwind for the commodity bull market. I just haven't decided if it's going to happen yet.
Well, I think the market will tell us. We don't have to decide for it, right? But
anyway, let's. And that was exactly my point before, is I think the market's going to tell us and tell us in a big way. And in the case of the dollar index, I think we're going to get that decision from the market relatively soon. I mean, in the next few months.
For sure. And so on page three, I wanted to just show that crude oil chart. And the crude oil has respected that 50-day moving average very well. I mean, it's interesting. It seems that 50-day moving average has worked well for all, not only commodities, but obviously the stock market and a whole array of different stocks. And what we had was a scenario where we had a very quick dip on the downside of crude oil, and it immediately got bought on dip and worked its way to the upper end of this range. What's particularly interesting about this is that crude oil seems to be poised for that potential breakout, but not very many other commodities are. And it's interesting that that crude oil is such a huge market on a relative basis to the other commodities. This certainly is going to be one of the big questions as to whether or not there's still a little bit more left in this reflation trade. If we see that punch to $70+ on the upside, that will certainly get things buzzing in the markets.
Yeah, notice also, Patrick, the tops all being aligned. Going back to the March high that we had in crude oil, that actually got up to 67.98 on the front month contract, not on the July contract, because back then, you know, in the beginning of March, at that point, the April contract was the front month. But the July contract never got above that. And we're right back up to pressing the same highs or testing the same resistance level on the contract chart that we were testing back in March. When we get through that level, the way I look at this is, even though it doesn't quite visually look like it on the chart, we've really been consolidating since March, trying to get above that 66.60 level on the current July contract. And I think that when that breakout happens, it probably sets the stage for a pretty significant move up from there. The thing is, I don't know if that move starts next week or not for two or three more weeks. We'll see what happens.
All right. Well, I wanted to just touch on some of the energy stocks themselves. So on page four, I have the XOP, which is the oil and gas exploration ETF. And I particularly chose this over the XLE, which is very heavily weighted in the majors. And what we have here is a chart that looks actually somewhat similar. It's pressing toward its 52-week highs. And I actually think that that this could break out here in line with oil. But one of the interesting observations I was going to make was we're starting to see divergent price action amongst the basket of energy stocks, particularly a few of those majors like ExxonMobil, which has been on the in the press, and a number of these other ones that are transforming themselves. And we're starting to see less and less energy companies actually breaking out. And so the breadth is thinning. And I'm trying to figure out whether or not that's significant, the fact that we don't have a very broad base participation on the upside. But certainly in the case of the XOP, I think it looks like it's poised to follow through if oil breaks out.
Patrick, it's noteworthy too that the closing print is what's most important, the closing price. And I just want to let our listeners know, I've described earlier in today's podcast in the market wrap, hey, it's not quite the close yet. We're still below 66 spot 60, and that's the critical level. As we're speaking right now, Patrick, we've still got 45 seconds left until the pit close, but the price is shooting up through 66 spot 88 as I speak. In other words, we're getting the closing print above 66 spot 60, and I think that's a signal that maybe a breakout is beginning that's going to take us much higher. We'll let you know next week whether that was right or not. In any event, Patrick, let's move on to page five, where you've got the metals and mining ETF, XME.
Right. And this is a broader basket of mining stocks. It has steel stocks and aluminum stocks like Nucor and Alcoa. And it also has a number of gold miners like Newmont and Royal Gold in the baskets. And so this, after just consolidating for a week, looks like it's ready to go for another attempt at a 52-week high. And it's really working higher. And so these mining stocks really don't seem to want to quit. And it really does feel like the price action continues to be very bullish, and all dips seem to be bought. And it looks like they're going to at least take a stab at making a 52-week high early next week.
Patrick, I agree. I think that both precious metals and other mining, like copper mining, looks pretty darn good here. And sure enough, on page six, you've got a copper chart. Tell us more.
Yeah, well, this is the Global X Copper Miners ETF, the COPX. And what's interesting here is that we once again are finding that 50-day moving average being tested on pullbacks. And in the typical fashion that we see price action work is that you have 52-week new highs, and then it mean reverts and corrects back toward the average, finds support, and then bullishly breaks out. And here we have that same scenario playing out. It'll be really interesting to see whether this is where a brand new bull advance in copper can begin.
Patrick, you've got the URNM, Uranium ETF, on page seven, which has more than doubled since I bought it when they first advertised on Macro Voices. What's going on here?
Right. And Larry was talking about uranium quite a bit, and I thought it was worth putting up some charts on this. And again, almost all of the cyclical style resource companies and ETFs for them have just remained so very bullish. This uranium ETF made a fresh 52-week high in May. The entire consolidation has been just sideways holding at, above all of its previous highs that made in February and March. And once again, is attempting to break out higher. I know Larry mentioned companies like Cameco, which continue to press 52-week highs as well. And so the uranium space continues to behave very well. And so with the uranium doing well, what's interesting is we move on to page eight there, Eric. We have the gold miners ETF, the GDX. And what's interesting is the gold miners were the ones in the doghouse through much of the start of the year. The first quarter of the year, they were just not participating while almost every other resource sector was. And what we've seen is since the start of April, that really clean bullish breakout on the upside. And the gold miners have really joined the party. And it's interesting to see that during the pullback that we've seen in copper and a few of these other areas, gold has just held up like a champion. It'll be really interesting to see whether, when we inevitably get some sort of a market correction, whether it's rapidly bought on dip to show the characteristics that are very typical of something that has begun a new bull cycle.
Now, Patrick, Larry also emphasized the importance of coal mining. Is that why Arch Resources is here on page 9?
Yeah, I just wanted to put some context into where the coal miners were. They were one of the last spaces to start joining the commodity bull market party, right? And when we look at Arch Resources, the ARCH, we can really see that it spent an extended period of time consolidating through almost all of 2020. And just recently, here in the last month, have we broke above all of those previous highs around the $50-$52 range that were there for the last 6 months. And so it really does look like the coal miners are getting a little bit of a breakout, and we'll see whether that leads them to heading back toward their 2019 and early 2020 highs. What I also wanted to show, though, was another coal miner in Peabody, and this is a far more volatile one, symbol BTU on page 10. And what's really interesting is just shows the devastation that the coal miners have been under during the last 2-3 years that saw the stock wipe out from $45 basically down to under a dollar. And we're really now seeing an extended basing formation establish themselves, and they're just starting to turn up. It'd be really interesting to see whether that view by so many people, including Larry, that these coal miners are turning really starts to gain some traction.
Well, Patrick, it's a really interesting story because the ESG movement has essentially shamed the professional investment community out of investing in coal, even though it's actually a profitable investment. That leaves opportunity for other people. In any event, for our listeners who want an even better deal, you can get Patrick's service, Big Picture Trading, completely free of charge. Well, for the first 14 days anyway, by signing up for a free trial at bigpicturetrading.com. Details on page 11. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better meet the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Abra Silver Resource Corporation, a premier emerging silver and gold exploration company, ticker ABRA on TSX Venture and ABBRF in the United States. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
You're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to download Larry's Bear Trap report and the link to the chart book that we just discussed here in the postgame. There's also a link to Zoltan's latest shocker, The Taper Will Be Bullish If... as well as a link to Seth Levine's article, Inflation is Shortages and Thankfully Transitory. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that's Eric spelt with a K, and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.